Today is Monday, August 14th, 2023. This is part 13 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N, last name M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing well.
Great. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. I have on my notes to ask you about your recollections of Page, Arizona, when you moved there in the late 1970s. But we just started talking about some things you'd seen on the internet, and I wondered if you'd be willing to talk about those things here while the recorder is going.
Sure. I dearly, by accident, and it was off. Well, I had been looking at your site, so I assumed that it came that way, but Facebook may have just thrown a curve out of the cloud, but I was looking at Bob Bordash, B-O-B-B-O-R-D-A-S-C-H, and he posted several pictures of trips, backpack trips that he's made over many years, 20 to 30 almost, into the Grand Canyon, and especially into the Kanab Creek area on several different levels of the Esplanade and the west side of Kanab, the east side, and going all the way around to Torreweap and the access routes, the trails, and especially his knowledge of how to have multi-day backpacks through the area, and I was just very enthused and moved, actually, that you have, I was not aware, I had hoped, but I was aware that people were actually going into that area of the canyon and enjoying it and using it safely and respectfully, and just that it's a marvelous place to explore and camp and be for a while, and he does good work as far as telling and describing his trips off the top of the maps, and I was especially interested in his a companion website, the Rock Artists, the Grand Canyon, and he has magnificent pictures of magnificent, especially pictographs in that area on the north side and on several of the drainages that come into Kanab Canyon there.
Mm-hmm.
And he presents them really well, documents them well, but goes out of his way very successfully to keep it secret where they are.
Nice.
You can read the sites, you can, his site and trip, and but there's no real indication. I think if you walked by there on the trail, you might not, you probably wouldn't know there were any magnificent rock art panels there. And that's, you know, I think an important thing, and I mentioned to you that and you mentioned the problem of how do you preserve these places, because publication of them just destroys them.
Right.
People that mean well otherwise can attract enough other people. It just takes one person to really destroy something like that. But it's a always been a problem I've felt, and I was happy to see this fellow's trips in an area I really love. And when I left that area and moved to Page, well, to Fredonia first and then to Page, really didn't have a lot of trips in there. And going back, and I always regretted not being able to spend more time down in I'd call it the Kanab Creek Wilderness, Grand Canyon, etc. Just such wonderful things down in there.
Yes, it definitely is magical country. Do you have any thoughts on the protection of that land? There was some discussion, there's always discussion of it's below the rim, and so it should be in Grand Canyon National Park, not part of the U.S. Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I just, you know, last week that President Biden set aside some land somewhere that he considered north and south of the Grand Canyon.
Yes.
Adding more protections, but which is good, and it, you know, this is an ongoing question and issue because I can't find anything that tells me where that was set aside, especially on the north side. But what you're asking is correct. It's, you know, a mixture of national forest, bayou, tribal lands, BLM lands, national park lands. When I started, everything over there was in Grand Canyon National Monument.
Right.
And then it's now the national park. And the other part that is land use is a big issue because to get these places designated, which is the first little tiny step toward protecting, I've noticed, and even this new area, grazing is not affected, hunting is not affected, all existing uranium prospects are still valid. They just cannot file any new ones, but there's probably 10,000 uranium prospects and claims throughout the north side of the Grand Canyon there, and in Kanab Canyon especially. And so it's, I know why the department, to get the designation, they have to leave it, you know, as it is now.
Right.
Things, everything's grandfathered in with the hopes that gradually over the years, it'll become more popular to make more preservation there. As I think of Kanab Canyon, the upper and the various ranges and canyons around Kanab Canyon, that, you know, it's much the same as it was. I was really amazed to see the amount of trail work that's been done in the Sawatz Canyon and, you know, actually constructing modern trail.
Yep.
Going up stone stairs where before you were just brush walking. And trail signs around the point on the Esplanade, you know, the ranger trail over, things that are flabbergast me, but I'm really thrilled. But, you know, who is being attracted? And as I can see it right now, I'm amazed that, you know, it was the mid and late 60s that I was in there, which 50, 60 years ago. And I think the canyons there, they're still there.
Mm-hmm.
It's still protected by it protects itself. It's difficult to get in there.
Yes.
It's, there is some access. There's some trails that are signed and trailheads at the rim, and you drop off into the canyon around there. But I don't have any great upsetness or fear about it right now, and I have the hope that everything will kind of work out over the next 50 years to where that can really have protection with, or maybe it just goes on and all this hodgepodge there that works, doesn't, it's better than nothing, is I guess to answer your question.
Right, right. Yes, the new national monument last week includes lands to the south and west of Tucson on the south side that are
right.
In the national forest in the Tucson Ranger District, going west to the Havasupai Reservation,
right,
and north to the boundary of Grand Canyon National Park. Includes the area around Red Mountain, Red Butte,
yeah.
and that area. Then on the north side, the House Rock Valley BLM land, south of Highway 89A.
Okay, I didn't hear that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and then on the far northwest side, west of Kanab Creek.
Yeah.
But going across to Grand Canyon Parashant National Monument.
Yeah.
So it's a Bureau of Land Management area in there. Covering a lot of areas that have been, as you say, claimed out for uranium mining. So it's a fascinating and I'm all for it personally. The preservation of these lands is very, very important, as you say, and sometimes it's a slow effort. Looking forward to future protections, strengthening future protections.
At this point, I don't think we know what that's going to look like.
That's right. Yeah.
50 years from now.
Yeah.
What is it going to look like?
That's right. That's right. Yep. Well, I'm interested to know your impressions of Page when you first moved there. And what year was that when you moved there and what brought you to Page?
Okay, I step back one more step where I left the Park Service and started a back trip business out of Fredonia where my wife was teaching school, and we had a home there on a couple acres, and I could keep the back stock, and had trips, for probably 7 or 8 years into the canyons and north all the way to the Wind River Range in Wyoming and back, pretty much all spring, summer, and fall. But the problem was when the son was born, and I really enjoyed being home with him and could see that the lifestyle I was enjoying was not compatible with family, I decided to sell the stock truck and the horses and mules and went down to University of Arizona in Tucson. We moved down there and spent 2 full years, got a degree in elementary education, and came back, and for the first time in many, many years, there was not an opening at the Fredonia school system. And so we looked a little further and knew people at Page, and actually the principal there had been down at U of A recruiting, and
oh.
I went in and talked to him, and he just basically all but gave me a contract on the site. And we talked about it, Sharon and I, and decided that was a good place to start. We knew a lot of people there. It was much the same environment. And so in the fall of 79, I got the contract in the summer to teach second grade in Page Schools. And the amusing part to me, I was in school all summer session finishing up, and actually I was up there on the job before I graduated. They had a special setup where your last few weeks, if you had a contract, you definitely, your teachers all said you're going to pass. They just let you go and sent you a certificate when the graduation was. We didn't have a place. We had a place in Fredonia that was rented out, but I actually, the first 2 weeks of school, I lived in my tent out at Wally Campground.
Oh my gosh.
And would, in a sense, dress up every morning and drive into school and, and come back out to the camp. We did buy a home, a mobile home in Page, and that was the fall of 79. And Page was quite a small town then. The power plant had been built, and that whole construction was gone, and it was over. And we, you know, I really enjoyed the teaching there, especially the kids. I really was effective at dealing with all these little 8 and 9 year olds. And the thing that kind of came out from my background was that teacher salaries were minimal then compared to, you know, just as they are now. And there was a, well, I had to have a second job.
Okay.
And I had been asked, they had a, Yavapai College had a satellite campus at Page, where, and it was just in the high school. At, it was a night school, extended extension service, all sorts, where people could get, you know, freshmen and even sophomore classes, and being adults could start, if they wanted to get back to school, they could go to these classes. And they were mainly taught by teachers from Page, but under the umbrella of Yavapai College.
Okay.
And they asked me, I don't remember who, how, or why, but if I'd teach a geology class. That was one of the normal freshman classes that they thought there'd be some interest in. And so I couldn't say no. That interested me quite a bit. I had been a geology major in my first college attempt, and I had enough courses, and they agreed. And what it became was quite bizarre, because the group said, there was quite a group that was enthused with this, that were hikers and explorers and car campers and mainly teachers, but who went into the, really explored the area. And we all talked, and I ended up doing a backpacking class, geology class.
Oh, wow.
And we'd meet one night a week where I'd teach the geology. And then every other weekend, we went somewhere, and I taught the geology on site.
Nice.
And we went, I remember, out to Tulip and camped and did the whole geology of where lava flows out there.
Okay.
Went to Wupatki and camped and saw the volcanics and earth cracks around that area, and up on the plateaus of north of Page, had one good session where we, all drove up on top of Navajo Mountain and camped for 2 nights.
Okay.
And I actually, did teach geology, and they did learn about the area.
Nice.
But it was really wonderful fun of getting to know people, and it was, to me, a very great success. I had one notorious, it's been impossible to live down event for a weekend trip west of Page into the Perea Canyon area, up by the Cottonwood Canyon. And I don't know if you've been on the road that takes off Highway 89 going north. Now it's all red. Staircase Escalante National Monument.
But, right. And it goes all the way up to Escalante. Okay.
Yeah. And so going up there about 10 miles, there was a canyon on the left called Hackberry Canyon that I had hiked in and photographed years ago. And that was perfect because there was water, and there was a nice slop canyon at the first, and beautiful campsite up there and a bunch of cottonwoods. And the only risky part was driving that access road across the first 10 miles of clay hills.
Okay.
Because if it got wet, you were in trouble. And we went and backpacked up to the camp there and spent the night, this quite a large group, just being at least people, maybe 20. But then it rained a little on that night, which we had not anticipated. And we came out, and it rained off and on. And we got out to our cars at the mouth of Hackberry, and we're faced with just a sea of mud.
Oh, wow.
Axle deep. And several wanted to risk it, and I said, no, you have the choice of breaking down right here, getting stuck over the hill. Let's look at what we've got. We've got this beautiful grove of cottonwood trees Everybody's got leftover snacks and sandwiches and food. We've got our tents. We've got our sleeping bags. And there's plenty of firewood. So I just said, we're not going anywhere now. I don't think it's going to rain tonight. This was in the late afternoon that we got out and found this thing. I said, by tomorrow morning, the clay will probably set up enough so that we can get out. But please don't go now. And so we camped there. Everyone shared their food. We talked around the campfire and had a really good time.
Nice.
You know, the people kind of antsy because wondering about families and they were expected home and all of this.
Sure.
We went to sleep. I had my son and daughter, which she was just 4 or 5 years old and hiked up the stream with a little pretend backpack on, and my son was about 8 or 9 years old, and we were just fine in the tent. It drizzled a little, and then we were doing really good. And then about 3 in the morning, there's all this noise, rumbling and roaring and roaring and rumbling, and we stick our heads out of the camp, and I remember there's this whole wall of headlights heading towards us. They didn't come in a line. They all lined up and came up to the camp and stopped. And it turned out it was the Kane County Sheriff's Search and Rescue Patrol.
Right.
And one of the ladies on the trip, her husband was the chief of police in Page, and when she didn't come home, he called the Kanab sheriff and said, any chance you can go do a welfare check? Because this whole group hasn't come home. So they did at 3 in the morning.
Oh my gosh.
Totally churning up the whole territory with their big four-wheel drives. They had got in and they said, yeah, with four-wheel drives, you can get out. It has set down. And so, reluctantly, because I would have just stayed there till it got dawn and had breakfast and driven out easily. But everybody packed up their tents and gear, and we got in there, and I followed the 8 or 10 big four-wheel drive rescue vehicles out, and it was slick and slippery. They all agreed we definitely could not have gotten out last night. But then we come, everybody got home before dawn
with
wild tales. And like I say, it's been hard to live down to this date, even though to me that was no reason to rescue us. No one was in any danger or problems. It was perceptions. And, but that's kind of my remembrance of Page in the early days of hiking everywhere with people you've interviewed with Ada Hatch was and is a very close friend. Gary Ladd arrived probably the 2nd or 3rd year after I was there, and photographer, and we became close friends. And he actually took the classes too and enjoyed it and take pictures occasionally. And,
so you would have been teaching with Ada at the school then?
Yeah. Yeah, she was 5th grade, and I was in the elementary. The 5th was actually in the middle school then. It varied as the school got bigger.
Okay.
Because, Page only had, 3 to 4, and then eventually 5,000 people. but we had this huge school
that
had over 1,200 kids in it, and it served all of northern Arizona up there, all the Navajo reservations from Inscription House and Kaivato and down to Bitter Springs.
Oh, wow.
Across the rim there on 89. All were bussed in. And it was a large operation. In the end, there were like 8 or 10 classes of each grade level.
Wow.
So, and we had occasionally big classes, too. But it was a big operation. We finally built the second elementary school, which relieved the pressure on the original one. But that was I just remembered the really popular class that I taught, two that I'll mention. One was native edible plants of northern Arizona.
Wow.
And we went, that was a really great one because we went out every other week and collecting, mainly on the north rim. It was where, the Kayabab, in either the lower levels in the pinyon junipers or up in the top. And it's just a marvelous place for collecting everything. We were successful. And then we would meet the next week. Well, they'd add the class was to whatever you gathered, you got to cook something and bring it to class for us to enjoy. So it was a big potluck. And we would talk about it. And occasionally people got, comfortable enough that they'd bring in the disasters.
Oh, my. Huh.
Some of the stuff you gather and cook can be really bad.
Huh.
Even though the Native Americans ate it, so-called. I put it in quotes. But and that turned out to be the only requirement for the class. You had to at least prepare two items of food that you collected and share with the class. And
nice.
That was very popular. I did that 2 years. A lot of people on the page wanted to do that because they found out it was so much fun. And
cool.
We got to camp out, on the North Rim several times on top of it. So that was really fun.
What were some of your favorite dishes?
Pardon?
What were some of your favorite dishes?
It was using a lot of pinyon pine nuts.
Okay.
We were lucked out with an incredible big, whatever you call it, harvest out there.
Great.
That year. And that was actually the easiest, learning how to shell them with a motto and a machete, and then, making them, put them in cookies or using it in salads and anything like that.
Okay.
I did a lot of, extended it into corn and powder, harvest and use dried corn. How did the Paiutes use a lot of the grains, and the Hopi used the corn, and we spent a lot of things with that, and then some of the plants that you could add to a salad, and that It just, you know, I learned a lot of from the Paiutes and a lot of the Hopi things that I had read before, but hadn't really thought about the details and how you're going to do this. And it was a fun experience. Oh, lots of berries. We were lucky with raspberries and elderberries and the other, I can't think of what it is, but out there on the rim in the wet areas. And that was really good fun. And also a lot of discussion of what not to eat. Just because one of the guides said, oh, the Native Americans used it. Well, a lot of discussion of what was edible and what was palatable.
Nice.
two very different things. So, but those were, you know, good days. I remember them well.
When I think of Paige in the 70s and 80s, I think of the places like Antelope Canyon and Horseshoe Bend, which weren't discovered yet.
Right. And we were definitely experienced that whole thing. I don't know if I mentioned before, but the Horseshoe Bend is a good story because Ada Hatch has a really nice ultra-modern solar house on the rim up in Page, looking over at Marble Canyon and the North Rim. And we used to meet there at least once a month with this big group for a potluck supper, and we'd watch Gary Ladd's newest slides and experiences and just have a good evening.
Nice.
And I remember specifically, he had some transparencies that he showed of Horseshoe Bend. It didn't have that name then. And they were great pictures. And he said, well, I just took these. And everyone was just enthralled by the place. And every one of us asked, you know, where is that? And he just turned around and pointed right there, you know. You see that little knoll, you go over that knoll and down to the rim, and there's this huge bend in the river that's really photogenic.
Huh.
And the next day, I remember, many of us met out there because we all drove out in our four-wheel drives, and you could drive up to the top of the little knoll and then drive down and out to the rim. And we were just amazed and enjoyed it. And Sharon and I, in the next few years, we'd often go out there on a Sunday or a Saturday afternoon or something and just want to gather our wits before the new school week and just sit out there and enjoy it and talk about it and never see anyone else.
Wow.
But, and the other story is Antelope Canyon. And that was better known, but it was completely undeveloped. No, you had the power plant up there, but down below. But everybody knew about it, and you just drove through and unhooked the barbed wire fence gate and went in, and you had to have a good four-wheel drive and be prepared to mount, not to stop until you got up to the canyon mouth. And we went up there many times walking through, really, and again, no one there. The thing that I tell that people have a hard understanding is that it was a school, but I think it was even the church, the Mormon church for the youth, had one and maybe several Halloween spook houses at Antelope Canyon.
Oh my gosh.
In the dark, and they'd haul all the kids up there, and they'd have a huge bonfire out at the front, and kids that, you know, were really daring would go up through the canyon because the sponsors were up in there with masks and things and costumes and leap out of the dark at you. It was a really an incredible haunted house experience.
A haunted canyon.
In the canyon.
Huh.
And, you know, it's, I remember I wasn't interested in haunted houses at all and never went up in there. But that was everyone's experience was, oh, yeah, I remember we went up there to the haunted house.
Yeah, interesting.
And another one was early. We had bought our house. We had a house there probably 3 years after we moved there. And I know for Christmas, Karen's parents and her brother and sister and her sister and brother-in-law and their son came up for Christmas, and we needed something interesting to do. So it was probably the Saturday before, we loaded them all up in our 4-wheel drive and drove up to Antelope Canyon. There's no one there, didn't see anyone. Walked up through, they were just really excited about the place and just enjoyed it. Brother-in-law got some really good pictures. We got out at the top end, and there were a couple of cows grazing up there, and didn't think much of it, but about halfway down, going back through Antelope Canyon, we hear the cows coming down the canyon in the fog, and they really, I don't know if they followed us or if they just did that normally. I think they normally went back and through the fourth through there. They just came strolling by, talking away, mewing, mooing, and everything. But they had these big horns sticking out.
Oh my gosh. Wild cows.
And we had to back up against the side of the wall of the slot and have these four cows walk by snorting away, and you know, you could have tapped them on the rear as they went. It was so close.
Gosh.
I know my mother-in-law was utterly petrified, or she would never come back to Page, and I don't think she ever did.
Oh my gosh.
We just loved the experience, and it was just one more thing to share with everybody. All our friends howled about it.
Huh. Wow.
Back then, you really couldn't get down in the lower Antelope without rappelling and doing a lot of rope work. And I just never, a lot of friends did it, but I never got around to it.
What about Coyote Buttes?
Yeah, same thing. I was trying to think, but it was Ada, and I'm trying to think of a date because it was Sharon and I and Ada and our daughter, Laura, who was, I think, in high school, so that was in the 90s. But it was, we kept hearing about the wave and Coyote Buttes. Not too many people had been out there, some had, so Ada said she had been there and she wanted to go back and we wanted to go along, I'm sure. So we went out there and parked at Wiregrass Canyon, and there was no other cars and no parking area.
Right.
And we walked down there and walked up to the waves and really enjoyed that. And I could got some pictures, just, you know, really, well, this is a special place.
Mm.
But then she said, well, this is okay. Where you really want to go is up on top of the butte and see the arch up there and this, the two arches and the huge erosion pit that's about 20 yards wide that you get down in, and the wall of it opens up in an arch that looks out across White Pockets. And we went
right,
there, and
that the borehole
is where we spent most of the day.
Okay.
Really enjoying it. And then came back down, and you know what happened after that.
Yeah, yeah.
All the people. And it was basically the Europeans, because and the French, Sharon worked at the visitor center at the dam for one of those summers. And they had a really excellent topo map for sale, selection of the area, larger. And she said all these Europeans would come in and want this specific map of Coyote Buttes over there. And she said, you know, why do you want to go there? She had been there, and oh, and they said it's the wave, and they'd all say it in a way of an awestruck. We've come all the way here to see the wave. And she said, well, how do you know about it? And he says, well, it's in the guidebook.
Oh, my gosh.
Can I see the guidebook? And the guy went out and got the book from his car, showed her, opened it up, and there's this now stock picture of the wave prominently and giving all the description and the hiking and directions and how to get to the wave and how, you know, mystical it was and new age and all. And then, to me, and like we were discussing earlier on land use and all, I think the BLM's been very successful there with their closing the area and entry by permit only and very limited, 20 a day initially, and now more than that, but it's still limited. And I'm utterly amazed that I look carefully at all the new pictures and the place is still there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was just going to be worn down from all the boots walking across the sandstone layers. And it looks good enough that I almost would want to go back again, but not with all the people.
Nice.
I think it's been a success. They've tried several different things with lotteries and going online and signing up, and so many reserved to give out in Canal every day, so many out at the Perian. And all in all, I think it's a good deal.
Nice. Yeah, this is the question. Once we discover these amazing places, how do we protect them?
Yeah. Yeah. Because the one that Gary Ladd especially was the first to explore the area just east of there and south of the wave they now call White Pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me and another friend, and maybe there were four of us in all. And it was a very difficult four-wheel drive route out there just on basically no roads, old Jeep trails, and showed us a lot of it. I was very, very taken by the place and went back several times, found several really unique geologic features that were in unusual places. And Gary, in the later years, became very disillusioned there because, well, he came back once in the, well, there was just people cast all over. They had driven out on the slick rock, out onto the areas that were really unique when we had always camped back on the sand, away from the real features. And eventually, I think he complained enough that the BLM came in and brought in logs and moved rocks and got us an area, parking area and camping area.
Right, that's right.
But there's, I don't think they limit it yet. It's hard enough to get to the,
right.
That limit to it. But the European tourists, they rent four-wheel drive Humvees and Jeeps and pickups, and they're roaming all over the Paria Plateau and out to the White Pockets. And what we were mentioning, I don't know that there's been any damage out in the most fragile part of the White Pockets. There's some unbelievable things there that, you know, cannot take a lot of traffic.
Right.
So,
yeah.
We just didn't tell anybody.
Yes, yes. That's what we learn is, that's nice. Now forget about it.
Right.
Yeah. Huh. And did you spend some time at Lee's Ferry and at the Lonely Dell?
Yes. That was a major, major story. I mean, I spent several years there.
You know, Alan, we've been going a little over 50 minutes. I wonder if it's a good time to take a break here, and next time I can ask you about Lee's Ferry.
Well, that would be appropriate because, you know, I put in a lot of time there.
I'd love to hear about it.
Working there.
Yeah.
And studying it and researching and constructing. So that would be appropriate.
Okay.
When did you do this again?
What works for you? You know what, I tell you what, let's wrap up this interview here, and then once I turn the machine off, we'll work out our times.
Right.
Okay, so with that, let's conclude part 13 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Alan Malmquist. Today is Monday, August 14th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you.